This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode. Hello?
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing, Alicia? Is it Hi, Alicia? Jared.
It's Alicia, like Alicia Keys.
Alicia, got you. Yeah, whenever you're ready.
Okay. Seeing her in me. I'm sorry for your loss. As if you're lost. Like a forgotten wallet or misplaced keys. A phrase used to empathize, to quell unease. I've said it too, about pets and strangers. But never about you. I find you in my deep-set eyes and the cheekbones below. My hands match yours from 30 years ago. I see you in my summer tan that's dark by mid-July, and in the lines that arc around my mouth if I laugh or cry. No, I haven't lost you, Mom. That could never be. You're present everywhere, most of all, in me.
That was really beautiful.
Thank you.
When did your mom pass away?
June 22nd of 2019.
What was it about that phrase, I'm sorry for your loss, that really just kind of struck you?
I guess just I felt like everyone was saying it to me. And I, over the course of a year she was sick, I found more and more, I don't know, pieces of her in me and just in my life that I felt like she was less lost than she had ever been, in a way.
Mm-hmm. This was part of a larger poem?
So the original poem, I wrote it like very soon after she passed, and then the next verse said, you'll be present in my parenting when I have little ones to raise. Love I learned from you will comfort them on their bad days. They'll hear you in Proverbs I recite about flies, vinegar, honey, and you'll be the source for belief that time is more valuable than money.
Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now and did you fall in love last time?
Love was stronger than anything. Because
you never love anyone but yourself.
Love. Love. Can I
love? Today's essay is Widow Walks Into Wall, Finds Hope, published in April 2020. It's written by Betty Ann Moskowitz and read by Suzanne Torin.
The wall must have moved into the doorway when I wasn't looking, and I walked straight into it as I was rushing out of the kitchen. I had just burned my thumb on the oven rack while pulling out a casserole, having forgotten it was hot. This was before the pandemic, but after the funeral. What are the chances that becoming widowed on the eve of a pandemic and practicing self-isolation in grief will give me some perspective on life and death? Or, put another way, will I survive? Dinners without him are terrible. The worst time to heat a casserole and touch hot oven racks. Though practically speaking, weren't casseroles invented for giving to widows to heat as their solitary dinners? He and I didn't eat casseroles. We preferred steak, some fish, a chicken, a chop. Oh, we loved our lamb chops. Like Jack Spratt and his wife, he couldn't eat the fat along the rib while I devoured it. He didn't like the marrow in ossobuco either. How lucky to be married to someone who left all the good bits for me. Did I ever think that while he was alive? When we met, he was leaning against a wall at a party. dark brows, dark eyes, his head inclined to the girl next to him. He looked like just the kind of bad boy I was partial to, all smoldering looks and banked fires. And I was a little drunk, so I went over there. "Do you mind if I ask your fiancé to dance?" I asked the girl. She shrugged. "He's not mine," she said. "Go for it." He was a Brooklyn boy, back in town from the army, from Korea. On our first date, he smelled like camphor balls, and a moth flew out of his jacket pocket. I was a Bronx girl with literary pretensions, and I read everything I could get my hands on, good and bad, high and low, about love. I wrote poems and fantasized endlessly about those strict, strong, brooding men like Heathcliff, Mr. Rochester, or Rhett Butler. But I found out that his silences and those piercing eyes that fooled me into thinking of dangerous love and dramatic heartbreak were not who he was at all. His eyes were simply beautiful, and his silence wasn't fierce. He just didn't have anything to say at the moment. He wasn't a bad boy. He was a quiet man. Yet his kisses did taste like vanilla, and I began to feel that the unspoken could be as sexy as the withheld. So, we got married. I have to tell you, our prospects were not good. We had nothing in common. We didn't know how to argue. I made noise, he stayed silent. We didn't seem to want the same kind of life. I was a show-off. He kept a low profile. I had ambitions, while he only had exigencies to make a living. To support me, he would have said, since we were the post-war generation when husbands took care of their wives and the wives were grateful. By the time I knew the phrase passive-aggressive, and he knew pretentiousness when he saw it, we had two children. In the 70s, no-fault divorce, the sexual revolution, and feminism were in the news, and marriage breakups were common, if not rampant. He was still struggling to make a living selling medical equipment. I was writing and working in a bookstore with Doris Lessing, Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, Simone de Beauvoir, and company. I thought about life without him. I thought about redecorating my life with brighter colors, a more adventurous style, even another man, one with perhaps more wit, more words. The night he went out for a long walk and took the car, I was pretty sure he was thinking about it too. But as taxing as his habitual silence could be, there were certain things I had come to value and was not willing to give up. He was a great friend, a great father, a kind man who helped anyone who needed helping. So we made our way through the 80s. He started his own business, and we felt the pressures of that and of raising two teenagers. But by then, I had developed a taste for quietude, and he discovered he could make me laugh. When it looked as though my first book would be published, I worried that it would disturb the equilibrium of our union. Would his ego be able to take it? What would it do to us? I think I would have backed off, but he said not to be afraid. His ego didn't work that way, he said. He might not read what I wrote, but he knew it was good. He was behind me all the way. Life was sweet in the 90s. I was teaching, and there was room in our life for me to write and find my way as a writer. My second book was published. He joined a medical supply company that sent him all over the world. We had some money and a nice car, Sometimes he took me with him. Sometimes he brought home gifts and stories. He knew how I loved stories, and he brought me stories. On Sunday mornings, when he was home, from early March through October, we would sit outside on our little city patio and read the newspaper and have our coffee. A neighbor once said it gave her pleasure to see us there, quiet, in harmony, together. In 2000, he retired from his position as Director of International Sales, and I left my teaching job at the City University, and we settled in Woodstock, in our vacation house, where we built a life, made friends, worked, volunteered. We got sick and better many times. He took care of me, and I took care of him. Our children and grandchildren came to visit. We got a dog, Pete, so we would walk more. I walked Pete in the morning, and he walked him in the afternoon. I cooked. He did most of the driving and paid the bills. Once in a while, after he had a heart attack, he would say, "Come here, let me show you what I'm doing." But I didn't want to see, knowing he was preparing me for when I might have to do it on my own. He brought me coffee in bed every morning. 6 months ago, things got serious with his heart. 3 months ago, I began bringing him his coffee in bed and started doing both the dog walks and driving him to and from doctors. I also took over doing some of the other things, such as collecting the week's trash and hauling the big cans down to the end of the road. And I had let him show me where the water shutoff valve was in the garage. But I hadn't let him teach me to pay bills. So he kept doing those, breathing with effort. He was winding down, and we knew it. Here's the thing. We talked about it and didn't talk about it. He had learned to say some things, and I had learned not to talk so much. When he felt a pain or a twinge, and I would see it in his face and say, "What?" he would say, "Nothing." For me. When he closed his eyes in the middle of the conversation and fell asleep, I didn't wake him. I waited for him. We kept up what we could. He didn't have the breath to walk the dog anymore, but we drove to the market, and while I went in and shopped, he stood outside with Pete. He wasn't very hungry, but we kept our dinner hour. We had a cocktail, whether it was tomato juice or a beer, or, if he felt like it, a small scotch. We clinked our glasses and talked about the past, and laughed and held hands, and talked about the future and how we were going to get ourselves to a beach as soon as he felt better. We said our wish would be to end together, just like this. It had taken us 56 years to perfect the ordinary in this extraordinary marriage. He died just short of his 85th birthday. And a month before the pandemic that has landed me in the house, alone, having kitchen accidents and walking into walls. The pandemic distracts me. I sit alone, unable to be with my children. But I'm not thinking I would rather die than live without him. Instead, I'm thinking, after all that life, I hope I don't die. I want to see what comes next. And I believe that is what a lifetime of good loving can do. Thank you.
This podcast is supported by Cartier.
For my 20th wedding anniversary, my husband gave me an amazing letter. We were having lunch in the park, the same park we got married in. And in the letter, he talks about all of the journeys and things that we've done. And he says, if I said to you, you were going to watch African sunrises from Ghana, if I said to you, you'll eat breakfast in Paris and sleep in the desert, dance in the streets of New Orleans or ride a camel, all while by my side, at the time, it would have seemed like a wild dream. But yet, those dreams are, in fact, our memories. I cried like a baby when I read that letter. And I cry every time I read it. It made me feel in love. It made me feel in love.
With Love, from Cartier.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Before we get back to the show, we want to let you know that we're doing a survey about how you listen to this show and others. It will help us keep improving what we do, and we want to hear from you if you are a longtime listener or a new one. So please fill out the survey at nytimes.com/modernlovesurvey. And thank you. Hi, Betty.
Hi, Mia.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you doing today?
I'm so happy to talk to you.
Thank you.
Absolutely adore your essay. Are you still living in Woodstock?
Yeah, I'm still up here in the trees. I'm here with Pete, my dog.
Aw, nice.
And I've been alone since the pandemic hit.
Wow. And how have you been faring?
Well, the pandemic is awful. But I think in an odd way, it puts me in the same position that everybody else is in.
Mm-hmm.
And in an odd way, it's like a cocoon. I mean, every once in a while, the reality will pierce my thinking. And I'll think, well, when it's over, everybody else will go back to their normal lives. And then I will have to reckon with the fact that he's still gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that will affect me, but I do know that I live in the house with his presence and with his absence, both.
Yeah, yeah.
And so far, I've been able to manage in that way. Listen, I have my good days and bad days. We all do.
Mm-hmm, of course.
But I think in general, the end of the essay, and how, in what way does all that good loving help now?
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, it's like padding. It's just good padding. Hmm. So when you fall on your ass, you don't bounce too hard.
What do you mean by the good life is padding?
The good life, the good life. Yeah.
Okay.
All those years of support and the confidence that he had in me and that I had in him, and the ways that we negotiated all sorts of good and bad things in mm-hmm. our life together
mm-hmm.
Is like padding for now. And I think, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
We've done so much. I can do this. Mm-hmm. I can do this.
I like that idea a lot, of his love as padding and as a means of support, you know, even now.
Yeah.
Struck also when you talk about living in the house with his absence and his presence. How do you feel his presence?
I feel his presence in the kitchen, certainly, mm-hmm. when I'm cooking, mm-hmm. because I cooked for so many years, we had the same taste.
Yeah.
We both loved oysters, and we both...
No casseroles, yeah.
Except mac and cheese.
Yeah.
That doesn't count as a casserole. And when I'm in the kitchen, I'm instinctively cooking for both of us. Even when I was cooking for the two of us, I was always cooking for four or six, and then we would just And it was his job to sort of finish the leftovers, because I don't love leftovers. So I feel his presence. I feel it at dinner time. You know, the things that we just did together. Sometimes, you know, I still, if I'm watching Jeopardy and I get an answer, I always got the answers he never did. He was always sitting to the right of me. I'll turn to the right and say, New York or San Francisco. I feel as though he's sort of nodding. And of course, I do feel his presence at night. I sleep on the same side of the bed.
Yeah.
And he slept on the other side of the bed. And that's where Pete, the dog, sleeps. And sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and Mia, I hear snoring. That dog snores.
That's great. Yeah.
So those are some of the ways that I do feel his presence. Mm-hmm.
And do you think your routine has changed a lot?
It's hard. You know, you live with somebody for 56 years. If you're going to last, you're going to dovetail into one another's habits and likes and dislikes, as we did. And so one of the things we always did together was perseverate. If we went shopping, for instance, we would, should we get it now? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. And so we would sort of aid and abet one another's insecurities and perseverations. And I'm finding that I feel a new freedom in saying, no, I don't want it. Or, yes, I'm going to. And I've also been thinking about my so-called feminism, which is, believe me when I tell you, 50s, 60s feminism. Nothing compared to the women, my daughter or my granddaughter, or women of today. But I always thought of myself as pretty liberated.
Yeah.
And yet I lived a life in which I accepted that some work was women's work and some work was the man's job. He manned the screwdriver. And now if I have to screw something in, I pick up the screwdriver. I never pumped gas before.
Never?
Never.
That's staggering. Wow.
I know.
That's wild.
As a matter of fact, pumping gas was a big issue. We would drive up to the gas station and he'd say, you do it. And I'd say, no, I'll do it next time. You do it. I don't want to do this. And I just didn't.
So when you pumped gas for the first time, which is still incredible to me that you've never pumped gas before, what was that like?
Oh, I got all flustered and nervous. And I felt like I was going to be one of those people who would forget to put it back and drive away with the pump attached to it or something. I was just a wreck. I still don't like it. And it smells bad.
Yeah.
But then I thought, whoa, yes. I felt so strong. I was so happy about that afterward.
So it's been 6 months. What do you think has surprised you the most in this time?
You never know. I mean, there are things that you think are going to be awful that really weren't, like disposing of his clothing. On the other hand, I went to a farmer's market during the summer that we used to go to together. And I thought everybody there was a couple. And everybody was perseverating together. Should we get it? No, let's not. And I came home and I cried for days. So you never know what's going to hit you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you don't have a sense of humor in this life, man, you are challenged. And even now I laugh. I don't know if you know anything about the Jewish ritual of Yahrzeit candles, they're called. You light them on the anniversary of a death or something like that. But I bought a bunch of them and I just light them whenever I'm feeling the mood come on. And lately I've been deciding that what I'm going to do is light one around cocktail hour and clink my glass. So He's so before I light it, I take a slug of my drink and say, here's to you, babe. And and then I light it. But it just struck me so funny.
Thank you so much, Betty. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Mia. I enjoyed it. It was fun.
Modern Love is produced by Kelly Prime and Hans Buto and edited by Sarah Saracen and Wendy Dorr. Music by Dan Powell.
This week's essay was written by Betty Ann Moskowitz and read by Suzanne Torin. Our tiny love story was written and read by Alicia Gabe.
Special thanks to Julia Simon, Nora Keller, Mahima Chablani, Laura Kim, Bonnie Wertheim, Anya Strimian, Sam Dolnick, Corey Sika, and also to Ryan Wegner and Kelly Rogers at Autumn.
The executive producer of New York Times Audio is Lisa Tobin.
I'm Mia Lee.
I'm Dan Jones.
See you next week.